taken from Habakkuk chapter 2, beginning in verse 6. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself with pledges? Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them, because you have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the people shall plunder you, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that people labor merely for fire, and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, I'm just going to warn you, I bit off way more than I can chew today. That happens. We are continuing our series in the Old Testament book of Habakkuk. The overall theme that we've been exploring is trusting God while in troubling times. And today's passage is God's answer to one of Habakkuk's previous questions about God's justice. The question of God, why do you tolerate the treacherous? Why do you stand idly by as the wicked Chaldeans, aka the Babylonian armies, swallow up those who are more righteous than themselves? In other words, why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? And God is going to make it clear. Don't worry. I am sorting it out. I am actively sorting it out. Look at me again in verse 6. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him? So taunting involves verbal insults. It involves mocking gestures. It involves excessive celebration. Any kind of action or word that belittles or harasses others. Where we are probably most familiar with taunting is in the world of sports. Right? We have the silencer. We have Cristiano Ronaldo's like, calm down, you soccer fans. Or the late Mutombo's, not in my house. We saw it brought out again at the Olympics with Steph Curry's night-night. Like, it's done for you. It's that gesture that rubs it in the loser's face. And although there have been a lot of anti-showboating, you know, rules that have been established in certain sports, and we teach our kids, right, don't mock others, be good sportsmen. There's actually a really important place for taunting. I think I have your attention. Listen to this. The Bible provides language for it. So I'm going to blow your mind. This passage right here is one big God-given insult. But unlike the sort of ridicule that we're used to seeing and hearing where the losers are mocked, what chapter 2 provides for us is language for the losers to mock those who seem to be winning, and specifically those who are succeeding at other people's expense. It's been said before that when someone is crushing it, typically someone is being crushed. Babylon was crushing it. By all world standards, they were succeeding. I mean, expanding territories, bustling cities, increasing wealth. The drinks were flowing. The parties never stopped. There were plenty of bodies to do whatever they wanted with. And yet, through these five woes that we'll look at today, the Lord assures Habakkuk and his people that there is a day coming when all the nations that the Babylonians mocked and all the nations that they mistreated will then be welcomed to mock their tormentors. A great reversal is upon us, he says. And all those who've been intimidated and pressed down, those who had been shamed, those who had been intimidated and manipulated, will then rise up to make their enemies shake in their boots and tremble. Now, it may seem sort of ungodly of God. Sometimes that happens. It may seem sort of ungodly of God to encourage this sort of thing, but it actually points to the fact that at final judgment, which is the day we all anticipate, God will publicly vindicate the righteous, and God will publicly shame the wicked. And this will be what resounds throughout all the earth. Look with me again in verse 14. For the waters will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So what will cause the fame of God's goodness and the fame of God's justice to spread to the furthest corners of the world when God brings a stop to all those who seem unstoppable? When heaven breaks in and overcomes evil. And so what we see here is to the extent that these oppressive forces shamed and destroyed others, they will experience their own shame and their own destruction. Why? Because God is just. God is just. And while it may appear that evil goes unchecked, whether it was in Habakkuk's time or in the 21st century, while it may appear that evil goes unchecked, it will not. Let's look at these five woes, beginning with woe number one, verses 6-8. Woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long? And loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise? And those who awake who will make you tremble, then you will be spoil for them. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the peoples shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to the cities and all who dwell in them. So a woe is a statement of grief, like whoa. But it's also a warning, a pronouncement of warning, like watch out. Be prepared. Something is coming your way. And this first woe describes, as I described, a great reversal that is coming where the plunderers will be plundered. And the pressed down will rise up to take back what has been taken from them. Those who found success through violence and deceit will suddenly find that their whole life has been taken from them. They won't even see it coming their way. You see, God's process of renewal often involves a process of upheaval. If you're taking notes, you probably want to write that down. God's process of renewal often involves a process of upheaval. We tend to look at upheaval and an unsettled world and think, oh my gosh, where is God in all of this? God must have abandoned it. It's just going to be chaotic and trouble forever. Far from it. Far from it. God disrupts and turns upside down the world that he loves. And as we see here in Habakkuk, upheaval, even on a national or an international level, proves that God is at work. Because as God establishes his kingdom here on earth, It involves tearing down what is not of him in order to raise up what is of him. Woe number one. Let's look secondly at woe number two. You guys still with me? Verses 9 through 10. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. So here the wicked are described as birds of prey that swoop down and then pick clean the vulnerable and then return to their lofty abode to enjoy their spoils. Interesting point of history. Did you know that Hitler's hideout in the Alps? It was called the Eagle's Nest. The Eagle's Nest. But as this woe describes what seems so lofty, what seems so secure and unaccountable and unstoppable, will one day come crashing down. There's that line from Hamilton in the song You'll Be Back where King George says, oceans rise and empires what? They fall. They come down. It's inevitable for every earthly power. And this has been certainly true of all people groups and all nations that have risen up against God's people. Pharaoh rose and he fell. And Babylon and Assyria rose and they fell. And the Nero, that fierce persecutor of the Christian church, he rose and then he fell. And the Nazi party rose and then it fell. On and on and on. They all eventually come down. And not just by chance, not just on their own, but by divine intervention. As I look at this passage, it reminds me of that old Johnny Cash song where he says, sooner or later, God will cut you down. Sooner or later, God's going to cut you down. So this is a song of ridicule for God's people to sing out against evil forces who are perched up high in their nests. And God invites his suffering people to raise their head and to lift their voice and let them know, sooner or later, God will cut you down. God's going to cut you down. The visual here is haunting. Look at me again in verse 11. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. So for those who are perched up high, even their dwelling place will begin to haunt them. Even their stuff will begin to torment them. Like that scene at the beginning of the Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge goes to open up his door and he's confronted with the face of his deceased business partner, Marley, haunting him. For those who acquire riches and success, listen, and here's the point. For those who acquire riches and success through ungodly means, everywhere you turn, you will be faced with the echoes and the cries of those you wronged. Woe number three, verses 12 through 13. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? In other words, don't you know that God makes sure that nothing comes from ungodly wealth but ashes? God will ensure that the harder you work, the more exhausted you will become, and the more vanity you will experience. Your punishment will be that you never get to sit back and enjoy the fruit of your labors. You will never feel secure. You will always feel like it's slipping through your finger cracks. It will always be like you're looking over your shoulder. You will sleep every single night with one eye open, Like the myth of Sisyphus, every day will feel like rolling a boulder up a hill, only to watch it roll all the way down again and start again tomorrow. Vanity on top of vanity on top of vanity. And it's from God. Woe number four. Verses 15 through 16. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. You manipulated people. You made vulnerable people more vulnerable. And you abused them in various ways. You used your power and you used your influence to exploit people's weakness. You blackmailed them. You sexually abused them. You held their future and their careers over their heads so that they would serve your perverted purposes. Does any of this sound familiar? Does any of this history sound like it's repeating itself in Hollywood and in the music industry? But now the prophet says, it's your turn to be exposed. Now you will stagger. And like a drunk, naked man, the nations will look upon your vulnerabilities. And the poison that you passed around that filled your cup will come back around to you, turning whatever reputation you had left into utter disgrace. And you see, the extent of this exploitation isn't just people, but as we see here, it also involves land and animals, decimating everything in their tracks. So this is not just the abuse of bodies, this is the abuse of God's creation. But as we see here in verse 17, even nature will one day rise up and oppose them. Verse 17, the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to the cities, and all who dwell in them. I like the way that George Whitfield once put it. He said, haven't you ever noticed that when you come near the animals, they growl at us, they bark at us, the birds screech at us and fly away? Do you know why? They know that we have a quarrel with their master. They know. So even nature itself will bear witness to humanity's rebellion against God. Even nature says, listen, I got a bone to pick with you, man. Because you got to fight with my creator. And your fight with my creator means you got to fight with creation as well. Woe number five. Verse 18, what prophet is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies. For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. What is an idol? An idol is anything that we elevate in our lives to the place of ultimate. Don't just think shrines or statues or something from like an archaic past or somewhere on a remote island somewhere. An idol can be possessions, an idol can be people, an idol can be any number of things that we look to in order to give our lives meaning and worth and value and stability. It's what you cling to most. And as Martin Luther put it, whatever your heart clings to and confides in, that really is your God, your functional savior. What is an idol? It's your functional savior. What is an idol? It's the thing you cling to. So Pompeii is this famous archaeological site. It's this ancient city somewhere in Italy that was decimated by a volcano in the first century, and then everything beneath it was sort of preserved and stored. So archaeologists love this location because they're constantly unearthing like art and relics of culture and structures and people in very like unique positions. So I read an article that they made a more recent discovery that stood out to me. They found a woman clutching her treasures on her bed. This is what the article said. It said the woman was found on the bed carrying a small cache of treasure with gold, silver, and bronze coins, as well as some jewelry, including a pair of gold and pearl earrings. So one of the members of this archaeological team noted that, you know, for them, 2,000 years later, it was unclear what the sentimental value was behind these items. They didn't know the story behind them. But, they said, they must have represented something in the moments of chaos and terror. We do not know exactly what it meant to this woman, but it meant something special to her when her world was crashing down. It's a timeless illustration. What we grasp for, what you and I grasp for, in troubling moments reveals what we trust most in our lives. This is a moment of reflection for us. What are you clinging to? What do you desperately grasp for when your world gets chaotic, when your life gets tense? You see, the sad outcome here, the sad outcome of idolatry is that when we entrust our lives and we entrust our futures to lifeless items like idols, slowly but surely we are dragged down by them. Verse 19, woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake! And to a silent stone, arise! Can this teach? Behold, it's overlaid with gold and silver. There's no breath in it at all. This woe is just showing how silly it is that we look to these things, these lifeless things. And what this insult points out is that you are destined to worship lifeless idols, pathetically begging them to give you that which they cannot give you because they are lifeless. And the more you worship lifeless things, the more lifeless your life becomes. See, that's the truth that runs throughout the whole Bible. We become what we worship, for better or for worse. If we worship the living God of the Bible, we come alive through faith. But if we worship lifeless things, every single day is a forfeit of life. You guys still with me here? I'll try to land this plane. I told you, I bit off more than I can chew. So the Lord provides these empowering words of hope for those who've been pressed down to the ground. But listen how this passage closes in verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. So the progression of these verses is very interesting. From all of the oppressed people mocking their oppressors, to then all the earth growing eerily quiet. Silence. And it's not just the Babylonians. It's also the nations. It's also God's people in Judah. It's also you and me, eerily quiet. Why? Because in the presence of the Lord, who is in his holy temple, we all begin to recognize who we actually are in this story. We begin to see ourselves in both descriptions, the weak and the strong, the oppressed and the oppressors, the humbled and the prideful, the righteous and the wicked, the exploited and the exploiters, the God worshipers and the idolaters. You see, this is our natural tendency. When we read of good guys and we read of bad guys, we do not initially identify with the bad guy. That's why we ask questions like, why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? Because we assume, number one, there are naturally good people, and number two, We're one of them. This is exactly what happened to a different prophet named Isaiah. At the beginning of the book of Isaiah, we see the prophet casting woes left and right. Woe to you, and woe to you, and woe to those who commit deceit, and woe to the drunkards, and woe to those who call evil good, and on and on and on. But then we come to chapter 6 and something shifts because he describes a vision of God he receives in the same place in the Holy Temple. He receives this life-transforming vision of God and all of his beauty and unending worth, and he is wrecked. And he says this in verse 5, woe is what? Me, for I am lost. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Woe is me. I've shared this story a bunch of times, I know, but it illustrates it perfectly. At the very beginning of the 20th century, the Times was reaching out to a bunch of contributors to be a part of this piece, answering the question, what is wrong with this world? And they sent correspondence to G.K. Chesterton. They expected something witty and profound by the writer. And he wrote back something very simple. He said, dear sirs, I am. Yours sincerely, G.K. Chesterton. What is wrong with this world? Let's start here. Me. Me. The problem is sin. Rebellion towards God. And it may and will often manifest in various ways and in various people, but the same root of sin that led to horrendous things in history resides within each of us today as well. Why do bad things happen to good people, and why do good things happen to bad people? Well, if we are perplexed by this question and confused by this problem in the world, it means that today we need to step back and acknowledge an even deeper problem. It's as the Bible tells us clearly, there are no good people. There are no good people. Romans chapter 3, none is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good. And if you have any doubts about it still, not even one. Now, does this mean that we will do horrendous things like some of the figures that we read of in history? No. But it means that the same problem of sin that resided in their hearts resides in yours as well. We are infected with the same virus, so to speak. And we all require the grace and healing of Jesus Christ. The gospel is good news for not decent people. The gospel is good news for dead, wicked, bad people. Romans chapter 5, but God shows his love for us in that while we are still sinners, Christ died for us. Since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God. For if while we were what? Enemies. We were reconciled to God by the death of his son. Much more now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life. Jesus suffered violence. Jesus forfeited his life. Jesus was stripped naked. Jesus was shamed. Jesus drank the poisonous cup. Jesus bore the ridicule that we deserve so that we could receive the rewards that he deserves. And it's only through the cross of Jesus that enemies can be turned into friends. It's only through repenting of our sins, casting down our idols, and trusting in Jesus' saving work that we are reconciled to our Father and made new. Unrighteous people are made into righteous people. Not because we are morally superior, but because of God's transforming power. And it's only as we continue to keep the cross of Jesus central in our lives that we can humbly admit it's not them versus us in here, or the bad guys and us good guys. No, as we behold the cross, we humbly admit our mutual need for grace, our mutual need for forgiveness. As Leslie Newbegin put it, we all, in some measure, are both oppressors and oppressed. The gospel, the good news with which we are changed, is that the reign of God, present in Jesus, has brought us all together under judgment, and has, in the same act, brought us all together under blessing. In the presence of the cross, there are no innocent parties. In its presence, we know that we are altogether guilty and yet altogether forgiven, loved, and set free. The good news is that we are liberated, and it is out of that actually given liberation that our actions for justice and mercy flow. This is what changes our view of the world around us. This means that we stop drawing lines between the bad people out there and the good people in here. The gospel destroys racial superiority. The gospel crushes moral superiority. The gospel eliminates every form of pride and entitlement and thought that we are somehow better than anyone else based on age or gender or race or education or political affiliation or income or cognitive ability or developmental stage or record. The gospel eliminates any shred of pride we have left. And this is what allows us to love our city, to care for our communities, to serve our neighborhoods, because we remember that we are stepping into the ministry of Jesus, who is called a friend of sinners. Let me conclude, and then I'm done. What do we do with these insults? What do we do with these words of ridicule? Was this just for the people in Jerusalem back then, 2,500 years ago, or is it for us today? And I would argue it's for us today. We are supposed to keep taunting Babylon. See, in the New Testament, Babylon becomes an archetype that represents worldly power, demonic enmity towards God and his people. In fact, the Apostle Peter opens up his first letter as, quote, "she who is in Babylon." What the heck does that mean? It means the persecuted church in Rome. It's subversive language. Babel was Babylon. Egypt was Babylon. Rome was Babylon. It's our task today to determine what's Babylon. But today, it's a world under the enemy's sway, worldly demonic power that rises up against God's purposes. And yet, like in the time of Habakkuk, our enemy's days are numbered. In Colossians, the Apostle Paul tells us that among many things that Jesus accomplished as he was crucified for us on the cross, it says in Colossians 2, he disarmed the rulers and authority and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. So as we remember the cross, and as we remember Jesus' triumph over Satan, sin, and death, we are celebrating Babylon's downfall. Every time we repent of our sin, every time we cast down our idols, we are sending notice to our enemy that there is a new king in town, and his name is Jesus. When we walk in humility, when we care for the vulnerable, when we go low to serve, we are actively participating in God's work of tearing down the old regime. And when we sing of the work of Jesus and we celebrate his work through the Lord's Supper, we mock our enemy who, for whatever reason, still thinks he has the upper hand over us. Every time we celebrate the Lord's death, we remind our enemy and all of his forces, your days are coming. Jesus, our King, is coming again. And sooner or later, God will cut you down.